The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Deadly explosions in Kabul. Afghans and Americans are among the victims. It's exactly what security experts have been warning about.
The threat from ISIS is extremely real. We've been talking about this for several days. We saw it actually manifest itself here with an actual attack. We believe it is their desire to continue those attacks, and we expect those attacks to continue.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, Cuba saw historic protests this summer. Now a government crackdown on social media has Cubans asking, what's next? And climate change is fueling more natural disasters, and that's fueling a lot of anxiety.
It begs the question for all of us as mental health professionals, you know, are we all disaster psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers now?
Coping with trauma after climate change disasters. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Deadly explosions rocked Kabul today, including an apparent suicide bomb outside the gate of the international airport. Dozens are reported dead. 11 Marines and a Navy medic are among them. U.S. officials warn those numbers may grow, but that the mission to evacuate American citizens and Afghans will continue. U.S. Central Command head General Kenneth Frank McKenzie gave a statement and took questions this afternoon.
Anytime you build a non-combatant evacuation plan like this, and you bring in forces, you expect to be attacked. We thought this would happen sooner or later. It's tragic that it happened today. It's tragic there was this much loss of life. We are prepared to continue the mission.
The World's Shirin Jafari has been following what's happening in Kabul and watched today's Pentagon briefing. Shirin, what did General McKenzie say about how the bombs actually happened?
Marco, he said that we know at least two explosions took place in Kabul today. Kabul is the capital of Afghanistan. One of them was at one of the gates of the Hamid Karzai International Airport. That gate is called the Abbey Gate. And there was another explosion at a nearby hotel called the Baron Hotel. We know that both of these attacks were carried out by suicide bombers. That's according to the Pentagon. And these locations are, Marco, significant because they are both key places where the U.S. and other Western countries have been carrying out their evacuations in the past few days. There are also reports of gunfire and several other explosions in Kabul today.
Who is behind these attacks?
The Islamic State has taken responsibility. General McKenzie also sounded confident that the Islamic State is behind these attacks. This Islamic State is called ISK, or the Islamic State of Khorasan. They've been operating in Afghanistan for the past 6 years, and they are an offshoot of the Islamic State that was in Syria and Iraq. They've carried out several gruesome attacks in Afghanistan, including some at schools and hospitals. The ISK, Marco, is a rival to the Taliban, and some experts say that they're carrying out these attacks because they want to say that, you know, they're still relevant and they want to send a signal that they are still a force to be reckoned with.
And did General McKenzie say if he's concerned about more attacks?
Yes, absolutely. He said there is a possibility that we will see more attacks, and the forces are ready for threats coming in the next few days.
And what about evacuation efforts, Shirin? Will they continue?
General McKenzie said that the evacuations will continue. He said there are people inside the airport that need to be evacuated. He said that the operations will continue. It's important to note, Marco, that some countries have already said they're ending their operations in Afghanistan. Canada, for example, has stopped its flights. France, Italy, and others have ended their operations or said they will end their operations today and tomorrow. But the U.S. says there are at least 1,500 American citizens that need to be evacuated, and there are also thousands of Afghans who are at risk, and they are trying to leave the country. So in the next few days, we are going to see those flights continue. But what's clear, Marco, is that what happened today will have an impact on the process, which, by the way, was already complicated and chaotic.
Right. Did the general in his comments say anything about how he and the U.S. military are working with the Taliban leadership?
Yes, he said the U.S. military is working with the Taliban. They're sending them information to help stop attacks before they get to the airport. And this coordination will continue, he said, and we will see how this play out in the next few days.
So terrible news today, but isn't a scenario like this exactly what security experts have been worried, even warning about?
Absolutely. The U.S. has been warning about this. a lot in the past few days. Even the U.S. Consulate sent an email yesterday to all Americans insisting that they leave the airport because they said they have credible information that there are going to be attacks taking place at the airport.
The world's Shireen Jafari, thank you very much for your reporting.
You're welcome, Marco.
Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is in Washington today for his first face-to-face meeting with President Biden since both men took office this year. Bennett unseated longtime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu back in June. Now Bennett and Biden hope for a return to more stable U.S.-Israeli relations in a time of uncertainty in several areas in Mideast geopolitics. We're joined now by Noga Tarnopolsky. She's a reporter based in Israel. She writes for the L.A. Times and Haaretz, among others. Let's start with Bennett himself. Of course, he's the new Prime Minister of Israel. Noga, but who is he exactly? What's his background?
Well, first of all, he's a young man. He was born the year that Joe Biden was elected to the Senate in 1972.
Wow.
And he's Israel's most improbable prime minister. He heads a party of only 6 seats out of the parliament of 120. And he heads a coalition which you could call rickety or which you could call amazing, because it encompasses everything in Israel from the hard left to the hard right. And he's going to try and use this to his advantage when he does meet Biden.
So Biden and Bennett were supposed to speak today. Not sure when that's going to happen. But when they do speak, what is at the top of the agenda?
What was going to be at the top of the agenda was just a reset, a renormalization of U.S.-Israel ties. And following quick on the heels of that, I would say Iran and other regional issues, including the U.S. desire to reopen its embassy towards the Palestinians, which is its consulate in Jerusalem. However, with this tragedy in Afghanistan, it turns out to have been really bad timing for this meeting for him. And I think, again, that he's going to try and turn it to his advantage and try and offer something to Biden. As Israel's leader, he can show Biden as a reliable and impressive leader in the Middle East during this period when Biden looks like he's really fallen badly in this area. And I think that Bennett will try and push the notion towards the U.S. administration that Israel's the least of their problems. In the Middle East, you can count on Israel. He'll say, look at what's happening all around us.
So you made clear that Naftali Bennett is not interested in talking about a two-state solution. But where do the two leaders stand on this idea? I mean, Palestinian statehood, is this something that either Biden or Bennett are prepared to talk about right now?
Given what's happening in Afghanistan, I doubt it's going to be a major part of their conversation. But I do think it'll come up when their teams meet, and where they are is completely opposed. Joe Biden openly and consistently pushes for a two-state solution. Secretary of State Blinken said it yesterday out loud after meeting Bennett, with Bennett at his side. And Bennett just stands there silently. Bennett opposes a two-state solution. He opposes the establishment of a Palestinian state. But I think he's not going to make a big point of that during these meetings.
So Bennett has said there will not be a two-state solution during his administration. He's expanding settlements. And as you said, Noga, he's against the Iran nuclear deal. These are all areas where Biden and Bennett are at odds. Even if this meeting is kind of pro forma with Afghanistan looming, what could these disagreements mean for overall relations between the U.S. and Israel?
I don't actually foresee a big blow up. What you say is true. But for example, Bennett is saying that he's expanding settlements because he needs to say that to shore up his right wing flank. But he's not actually doing a lot to build new settlements. Nothing is geographically expanding, at least not for now in these first 2 months. And regarding Iran, I think that both Biden and Bennett can legitimately blame Trump and Netanyahu for leaving them a terrible legacy in which, after the United States left the Iran deal, Iran really raced ahead with uranium enrichment. And I think most likely we'll hear a little bit of that blame. Then I think they will try and move forward. I think Bennett will basically say to Biden, we prefer that you don't go back to this deal. But if you do, we want to have your approval for freedom of action on our part.
Noga Tarnopolsky is a freelance reporter based in Israel. Noga, always good to speak. Thank you.
Great to talk to you. Thank you.
In Cuba, the government is tightening control over social media. People on the island can now face criminal charges for posts seen to be sowing discord or spreading so-called fake news. This follows historic protests across Cuba this summer, and the government restrictions on social media have left many Cubans wondering what's next and how they'll be able to confront the government in public. The World's Daisy Contreras brings us that story.
It was just last month when thousands of people marched throughout Cuba. Many demanded an end to communist rule. Libertad, or liberty, they chanted. This video was taken in the city of Guantanamo. Many more like it spread on social media, on Twitter and Facebook. Those platforms were key to mobilizing the protests. The country's president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, blamed social media and Cubans in exile for inciting the protests. Now the Cuban government is tightening control on what can be shared on social media. Pablo Dominguez Vázquez is with the Cuban Ministry of Communications. In a press conference, he said the new laws are meant to protect the Cuban government and residents from cyber attacks and false information.
Temas relacionados con noticias falsas, relacionados con...
People could be investigated for spreading false news, he warns. It's not the first time the Cuban government has tried to control internet use, says Boris González Arenas. He's an activist and writer in Havana. Arenas was arrested last year for defying a previous internet rule. He says the state police dragged him out of his house, fined him, and took his cell phone after he criticized the former Fidel Castro regime online. He says the new rules expand on internet restrictions already in place. The rules, he says, are meant to intimidate journalists and activists like him. Cubans first got access to the internet in 2018, but many can't afford it. And one government company controls those costs. Accessing the internet through a cell phone is also expensive. But for Cubans who do manage to get online, there's a lot of confusion about what the government's new restrictions mean and what might be considered criminal. But Camilo Condis, a podcaster in Havana, has a bigger worry.
Lo que nadie habla es la discrecionalidad que se le ha dado de limitar o eliminar completamente el acceso.
What people aren't talking about, he says, is how the internet in Cuba is controlled by the government, so officials only need to point to their new law to justify shutting down the internet. Many attorneys and experts on Cuba's digital rights are fielding questions from worried Cubans, like at this recent gathering on Facebook organized by CubaLex, a legal nonprofit based in the U.S.
Todo el mundo tiene que tener claridad.
Attorney Giselle Morphy says Cubans need clarity on what's illegal and more justification for these rules, which she says are still vague. Meanwhile, activist Boris González Arenas, who was arrested in Havana last year, is counting on social media for protection so that if he's arrested again, people will know about it. He also says that the government's attempt to control internet use in Cuba is part of a greater challenge it faces.
Así de simple. Se les acaba el poder, se les está acabando.
They see they're losing power. At least that's what Arenas believes. So he'll continue to speak up online against the government, despite the risks. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Americans fully vaccinated against the coronavirus could be eligible to receive a booster shot as early as next month. But many health officials outside the U.S. think the plan is unfair, and no one has been more vocal about that than Dr. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the director of the World Health Organization.
I'm disappointed because so far 4.8 billion doses have been delivered globally. 75% of that is in 10 countries. 10. Do you think this is acceptable? We call it vaccine injustice.
On Monday, Dr. Ghebreyesus called for a two-month moratorium on a third shot until more countries can get their people vaccinated. Vaccine inequities explored by our partners at The Economist in today's episode of their podcast, The Intelligence. There are clear ethical issues in vaccine inequity, but The Intelligence looked at the global cost of the imbalance. Agathe Demaret is their global forecasting director.
We asked ourselves a very simple question. If every country around the world managed to vaccinate the majority of their population by mid-2022, what would that mean for the global economy? faster vaccination timelines would add $2.3 trillion to global GDP by 2025. Or if we see the glass half empty instead, vaccine inequity will cost $2.3 trillion. And just to put this into perspective, that's roughly the size of a large economy like France. And unsurprisingly, emerging countries will shoulder two-thirds of these losses.
Agathe Demarest says that vaccine inequity has the potential to reshape not only the global economy, but also the political and social landscape.
First, politically, social unrest. Because of lack of vaccines, a lot of people around the world are unhappy with local governments, which are seen as unable to provide vaccines. And also, there's a lot of resentment against more developed economies, which are seen as hoarding vaccines. Another consequence will be on tourism and travel generally, because people who come from unvaccinated places will be barred from entering vaccinated countries. And the other way around, some people from vaccinated places like the UK may be hesitant to visit countries that do not have high vaccination rates. And finally, geopolitically, that's also a big consequence. Vaccine diplomacy from Russia and China will really get a boost from vaccine inequity because Russia and China are presenting themselves as the saviors of the emerging world.
Demarest is not confident that the divide can be bridged because the situation is so stark. Despite efforts to ramp up production, despite donations of vaccines from rich to poor countries, the divide, she says, is widening, and we will be living with the consequences for years to come. Throughout the pandemic, we've told you about how hard life has been for working musicians. Across the globe, concert halls and opera houses gone dark. In Jordan, the country's only symphonic orchestra has not rehearsed in over a year. Many worry it may now be shut down for good. Reporter Emily Pons traveled to Amman, the capital, to bring us a story of one conductor's double quest: keep classical music alive in Jordan and expand the boundaries of the genre for new ears.
Jordan's National Orchestra is housed at the elegant National Conservatory in the heart of Amman. I paid a visit recently to interview conductor Mohamed Othman Sidir. His office is very spacious. His secretary has her own office right before his, where an upright piano sits by the windows. As I arrive, he tells me he just taught a class to the French ambassador, but most of the other members of the orchestra haven't been working, and he's deeply concerned about the future.
To hear is very difficult. A country without an orchestra, it means parents won't believe in teaching their kids to be a professional musicians, but they are no future.
The National Orchestra has been on and off for many years. It was created in 1988 as the Amman Symphony Orchestra and was the third symphony orchestra to be founded in the Middle East. Sidir came to Amman in 1993 with the Iraq Symphony, and he was asked to stay to develop this orchestra. Under his direction, they performed numerous Arabic classics, such as the Coffee Cup Woman Fortune Teller. It's a song of doomed love based on a famous Arabic poem by Nizar Qahbani. The Amman Symphony was originally funded by the Conservatory. In 2014, it became known as the Jordanian National Orchestra, or the Jorchestra. Around 2017, funding sources dried up and the Jorchestra stopped performing regularly, only at special events, which made it hard for the musicians to earn a living. Amman opera singer Adi Naber says with the decline and disappearance of the orchestra, there is no incentive to become a musician, especially to learn certain instruments like tuba or bassoon.
It makes students feel there's no point in learning a musical instrument with the aim of joining the orchestra, as the orchestra doesn't perform frequently, so there would be limited opportunities for the musicians.
Naber says he knows the region has other priorities such as unemployment and poverty. And when the pandemic hit in March 2020, all operations ceased for the orchestra. Mohamed Othman Sidir was crushed.
And now there's no orchestra here, and all Arab world has orchestras.
And we had support here and there from the government sometimes, and it's always in, off, and it's not going to work.
Other countries in the Middle East, like Iraq and Egypt, are able to maintain their orchestras with government funding. The Cairo Symphony conductor Maestro Nair Nagy is concerned about a larger problem. He wishes there were more interest in classical music in the region.
We are selling something that is not a mainstream. Imagine the difference between selling Beethoven in Germany or in Syria. The struggle of being a classical musician, it's universal, of course, but we suffer much more in the Middle East for that.
Bridging that gap between Arabic and Western music is one of Sidir's goals as a conductor as well as a composer. He often writes pieces for traditional Arab instruments. Oud Hope pays tribute to the oud, which is a sort of guitar. Like most of Sidir's pieces, it also features classical Western instruments. Another of Sidir's compositions is called Khawater. It loosely means ruminations. It combines Arabic rhythmical sequences with melodic lines played by Western instruments such as the violin. Someday, he hopes to return to conducting. Sidir's dream is to create an orchestra of musicians from throughout the Arab world. For the world, I'm Emily Ponce, Amman, Jordan.
You're listening to The World. Chinese planes are buzzing Taiwanese airspace, and talk of war is in the air.
Taiwanese people want peace, but we know the risk of conflict is always there.
The spokeswoman for the president of Taiwan tells our reporter the island needs the U.S. to maintain its independence. That and what China's leader thinks about everything coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World, a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Remain in Mexico may be reinstated. That is the controversial Trump-era immigration policy that requires people who are asking for asylum in the U.S. to wait in Mexico for their claims to be processed. The U.S. Supreme Court this week told the Biden White House that their attempt to rescind the policy violates federal law. The Mexican government has something to say about it, too.
El fallo de la Suprema Corte de los Estados Unidos no tiene una implicación.
That's Roberto Velasco, a senior foreign affairs official in Mexico City. He's saying Mexico will exercise sovereignty in designing its own immigration practices. Meanwhile, on the other side of Mexico, on its southern border, a migration crisis is brewing. Mexican authorities are pushing hundreds of Central American migrants back every day into a rural border outpost in Guatemala. The World's Jorge Valencia reports.
The town of El Ceibo in Guatemala is a little speck on the map. It's basically a few stores catering to locals crossing the border, surrounded by marshland and hills. And it's been crowded over the past month with the arrival of busloads of people being expelled from Mexico. A man pushes a cart to sell phone chargers to a line of people who just got off a Mexican immigration bus. Guatemalan officials greet them. A woman from the Red Cross wears a surgical mask and a face shield.
And she is dialing phone numbers for people and then handing them a headset so that they can speak.
This is what it looks like when the Mexican government drops off people from all over Central America on the edge of Guatemala. 9 busloads arrived in one afternoon this week. I spoke with about 24 people stepping off the buses. They said they were detained by immigration officials in the U.S. or Mexico and swiftly removed without any opportunity to petition for legal entry or asylum. Walter Vides is a salesman from Honduras, and he says Mexican immigration officials told him they were deporting him to his native country. This is common procedure. but he says he and everyone on his bus realized they were being dropped off in rural Guatemala only when they saw a border sign. Vides says he's angry because he hasn't eaten in the 24 hours since he was detained and because he doesn't have any money to buy food. He says he's migrating because he can't find work. Honduras is a desperately poor country. Marvin Reyes from neighboring Nicaragua says he's fleeing persecution.
Okay, el motivo de mi salida de Nicaragua fue porque tenemos un problema sociopolítico en Nicaragua con el.
Reyes says Nicaragua has a socio-political problem. Human rights organizations have documented the systematic persecution of opposition leaders there. Reyes says authorities threatened him after he and several family members participated in anti-government protests.
Me vale más irme con todo y miedo a otro país antes que quedarme aquí con las manos cruzadas y servirme en bandeja de plata para ello, ¿no?
Vides and Reyes's experience are representative of many migrant stories here in El Cebo, and their personal challenges with poverty or persecution are symptomatic of the reality across much of Central America. Another experience many migrants talk about is having been extorted along their journey. Ezequiel Tercero is an electrician from Honduras.
De pronto me encontré con una persona ahí nativa y me ofreció trabajo.
Tercero says he was walking across El Salvador when the owner of a hardware store offered him work. He says he worked there for 2 weeks and used his earnings to keep traveling. Once he got to Guatemala, his money was gone in about 6 hours.
Policía, militares, la guardia, todo el mundo quiere su parte. Y usted,
the police, the military, the National Guard, everyone wants their part, Tercero says. And if you don't give them cold, hard cash, he says, they'll deport you. That eventually happened to him anyway when he got to Mexico. And that's what Maria Magdalena Hernandez says happened to her when she reached McAllen, Texas.
¿En Estados Unidos?
Sí, adentro, Estados Unidos.
Hernandez is a 20-year-old from rural Jocotan in Guatemala. She's traveling with her 18-month-old son in her arms.
Pues nosotros le dijimos que nosotros somos pobres, como realmente hicimos la verdad.
Hernandez says she told officials in the U.S. and Mexico the truth, that she's poor and she's looking for a better life for her son. She says U.S. immigration officials told her to take a shower and then put her on a plane to the southern Mexican city of Villahermosa. Mexican officials there put her on a bus to the border 4 hours south. Some of the migrants here in El Cebo tell me now they're going back to their country of origin. Others say that's not an option. Walter Vides, the salesman from Honduras, says he's between a rock and a hard place. As soon as he can, he'll try traveling north again. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in El Cebo, Guatemala.
As natural disasters increase due to climate change, so will the mental health challenges that follow. How best to tackle them? That's the focus of this week's Big Fix.
Change is coming.
Can we turn this around?
We have no other option.
What we do now will profoundly affect the next few thousand years.
Dr. Beppe Raviola directs mental health programs in 10 countries for the nonprofit Partners in Health. He's also a psychiatrist at Mass General Hospital. So, Dr. Raviola, over the past 2 weeks alone, we've had the ongoing crisis in Haiti and deadly flash flooding in Tennessee and Venezuela. What kinds of specific mental health challenges come out of this kind of trauma, like PTSD, I would imagine, but what other concerns?
When disasters happen, people are in a state of shock, both physiologically and emotionally. So their natural stress response systems go into overdrive, and that involves a cascade of hormones, neurotransmitters in the brain, and the peripheral nervous system in the body to trigger a safety response. So the broader mental health and psychosocial response to any crisis has to work to facilitate the regaining of a sense of actual safety. Mm. The two main things to always remember in considering taking care of mental health of people in disasters is, number one, to not over-pathologize and medicalize a terrible experience, since the distress people are experiencing is a normal response. And the second thing is that basic services need to be addressed first. That means food, water, housing, and information about what's happening. Pre-existing social networks can be reestablished, for example, through churches or creating child-friendly spaces. And so responders really want to consider how to support community members in strengthening community resources and how to also support existing primary healthcare workers in providing clinical support when needed.
Doctor, you helped set up a community mental health system in Haiti alongside local partners after the 2010 earthquake there, and now Haiti's in the wake of another earthquake. I want to ask you a couple of questions about how best to provide that mental health care in those days that follow natural disasters. So as you said, don't over-pathologize, don't necessarily need to swarm an area with psychiatrists, but more basic first steps like reuniting families, self-care, things like that. Can you talk about what those actually look like?
Yeah, well, you know, fragmentation and poor collaboration and communication among NGOs had previously defined quite a bit of humanitarian action in Haiti, even before the 2010 earthquake. And we've got to try to address this in developing both an emergency response and a longer-term response. So groups will need to undertake an inventory of existing trained mental health professionals in the area. One can expect that there may not be many. And so one can consider using an approach called task sharing, which involves the engagement of non-mental health professionals, that is community members, church leaders, community health workers, to deliver certain aspects of mental health care. And primary care physicians can also deliver aspects of mental health care. So task sharing is a key approach. And embedded within that key approach, we can use an intervention called psychological first aid. And psychological first aid is a commonly accepted non-clinical set of best practices to help non-specialists identify people in distress, listen to them effectively, and refer them to care. Physicians undertake medical evaluation, they prescribe medications, and then there are social workers and psychologists who can be mobilized to deliver more structured psychotherapies for people who don't recover after the emergency. But we expect that most people will recover their prior functioning in the months following a disaster.
So we've been talking how the response has been to mental health in the wake of an earthquake in Haiti, which obviously is not caused by climate change. But as I said earlier, I mean, these disasters happening in a lot of places do result in mental health issues. Is climate change changing the way psychiatrists or other people in your field think about mental health care?
Well, that is a great question. All that we've seen over the last couple of years in terms of COVID-19, structural racism, health inequity, migration fed by climate change, economic and social crisis, and political extremism, all of these are intersecting as a set of epidemics, really. And so it begs the question for all of us as mental health professionals, you know, are we all disaster psychologists, psychiatrists, social workers now? How do we think about, as I mentioned, non-clinical, non-health system approaches to working across sectors in society to build systemic resilience that integrates mental health and a public health mentality to confronting these crises as they come?
Psychiatrist Beppe Raviola directs mental health programs in 10 countries for the nonprofit Partners in Health. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Thank you.
The Big Fix is our weekly look at the work people around the globe are doing to curb climate change and its impacts. Explore all our coverage at theworld.org/bigfix. Let's turn now to Taiwan. The United States sells lots of military hardware to the self-governing island. China sees Taiwan as a renegade province, one that will eventually return to the motherland. None of that is new, but when Joe Biden recently suggested that the U.S. would defend Taiwan militarily, the White House scrambled, saying that Biden simply misspoke. Tensions are running high between Taiwan and China. Chinese jets regularly buzz the island in a provocative show of force. A conflict with China would have severe implications for Taiwan's 23 million people and for the future of American influence in Asia. The World's Patrick Nguyen spoke with Colas Yutaka, a former Taiwanese legislator and now the spokeswoman for Taiwan's president.
Ms. Colas, Chinese state media is pointing to Afghanistan and saying, hey, look, Taiwan, the U.S. can't protect you. You could end up like Afghan leaders flying away on helicopters. What do you make of that?
I think they are completely different situations. Lazy comparison between Taiwan and Afghanistan ignore the realities of both countries and show little regard for the immense human suffering facing many in Afghanistan today.
Well, here are some recent headlines. The New York Times asks, is Taiwan next? The Washington Post says the risk of war with Taiwan is growing. Forbes says the invasion will defy human comprehension. I mean, to read this stuff, you would think war is coming next week to Taiwan. Is that how it feels to your government?
The threats have been there for decades. So actually, we experienced similar threats many times in the past. So for us, none of this is new. But the point is, we are prepared. We have self-defense. That's the most important thing.
But on a day-to-day basis, is your government sitting around all day talking about war?
No. We are not saying it's not happening. Actually, we are pretty aware of this. I mean, Taiwanese people want peace, but we know the risk of conflict is always there.
You've said you are not anti-China.
We are not anti-China at all. We want equal dialogue and peaceful interaction with China without any precondition.
Beijing has said Taiwan formally calling itself an independent country would be grounds for war. Is Taiwan an independent country?
Of course, we are a sovereign and independent country already because we have elections, a president, a military, a judiciary. Obviously, Taiwan's independence is a fact.
But changing the constitution to say that, to say Taiwan is independent, that would be a big deal, right?
Yeah, but it's a decision for people to make. Only Taiwanese can decide.
On Twitter, you've said China is like a noisy neighbor.
They are pretty noisy. Actually, they threaten their neighbors. But that's the neighbor we are living with.
Well, Taiwan is becoming one of the freer places in Asia with more rights for media, more LGBTQ rights. How do you see your role as an island in a region that's becoming more authoritarian?
Taiwan is very different from China, culturally, historically. So we want to be ourselves. I think that's how majority Taiwanese people feel. So I do hope other countries can see this part of Taiwan.
People may notice that your name, Colas, is not a Han Chinese name. Some people think just about everyone in Taiwan is ethnically Chinese, people who fled the communist victory on the mainland in the late 1940s. But you are from an indigenous group called Amis, is that right?
Yeah, in Taiwan, we call ourselves Banza, as long as Amis. And Austronesian indigenous peoples make up 2.4% of Taiwan's population, more than 500,000. Like what you just said, we are not Han Chinese, and we have been living here for thousands of years. But we have different cultures. For example, my people, Banza, are matriarchal, whereas Chinese culture is very patriarchal. But this often get erased when people say Taiwan is culturally Chinese. Actually, we are very mixed.
I want to ask about the U.S. What does your government ultimately want from the United States?
The U.S. has been supportive of Taiwan. We are grateful. We would love to see the U.S. continue to support Taiwan's participation in international bodies like the WHO and other UN agencies. The U.S. has helped us enhance our capabilities. We appreciate that. But ultimately, we know it is up to us to defend our country.
But does Taiwan need the U.S. to remain independent?
Yeah. I think we need the U.S. support. We need to make progress. And we have to get better, and we can be better together.
Colas Yutaka there, Taiwan's presidential spokeswoman, speaking with the world's Southeast Asia correspondent, Patrick Nguyen. China has announced that the political ideology of its president Xi Jinping will now be taught in schools from elementary through university level. The Ministry of Education said its goal is to cultivate the builders and successors of socialism with an all-round moral, intellectual, physical, and aesthetic grounding. What's known as Xi Jinping thought has actually been enshrined in China's constitution since 2018. François Gaudemont is the author of Les Mots de Xi Jinping, or The Words of Xi Jinping. He's also a senior advisor for Asia at the Institut Montaigne in Paris. François, is there a way to summarize what Xi Jinping thought is?
Well, not easily, because it's a mixture of sometimes very personal aphorisms. But at the other extreme, it's literally a handbook on governance. Xi Jinping is a micromanager who touches just about every subject, but also conservative morals, which is much more akin to traditional China. And of course, Xi Jinping's talent is to mix both in a kind of educative brew that he has already imposed on the rest of the population.
So when Xi Jinping introduced this in 2017, it was a 3.5-hour speech at a party congress. It was called Xi Jinping Thought on Socialism with Chinese Characteristics for a New Era. What was the message for you that came through at the time?
At the time, it wasn't as distinctive as it is now, because he has really branched out. And we now have also, you know, collections of his speeches at various places and various times. It's become more and more militant. It's obsessed with struggle. It's both class struggle, but struggle also with China's external enemies. I think in 2017, it was still a kind of catch-all ideology that was quite compatible with what his predecessors have said.
Were you surprised then by news that Xi Jinping thought will now be part of the Chinese school curriculum?
Not at all, because it has already spread through society. For example, there are several apps that broadcast Xi Jinping's thoughts and allow people also to literally train in memorizing and repeating them and using them. And these apps are downloaded hundreds of millions of times. There are Xi Jinping thought centers in just about every university and institute.
Wow.
There is a Xi Jinping thought center, for example, at the institute affiliated with the Minister of Foreign Affairs. So extending it to kids who in any case are, of course, submitted to propaganda in their history and ideological courses is not a surprise. Xi Jinping is really now, you know, taking front row seat on just about every ground in preparation for the Party Congress of 2022, which would extend most likely his reign beyond 2 terms.
So what kinds of things will pupils and students be actually taught? Like, give us a sample of the ideas that Xi Jinping believes in.
He believes in morals and anti-corruption. He believes in the power of will. It's an ideology that's focused on voluntarism. In that sense, it distinguishes itself from what you could call traditional Marxism and materialism. It's much closer to Mao Zedong, in fact. It makes a definite distinction between friends and enemies. It's absolutely central.
And how does Xi distinguish from friends and enemies?
I think the criteria is socialism and Chinese nationalism. So even though he has an undertone sometimes about criticism, criticism is correct, for example, if it unmasks enemies, but you've got to watch out with criticism. So anybody who has a free mind is likely to be targeted. And one aspect of Xi Jinping is that he's very versatile. For example, during his ascent to power, he actually courted private entrepreneurs and even foreign enterprises because it suited him. It was the language of the time. And also as a provincial leader, he needed these guys to have a better economic record. Now he's leading an onslaught against them, starting with the Chinese entrepreneurs and probably going on to foreign enterprises as well, slowly, you know, diminishing their role. And that is very close to Mao as well, who can, you know, as you say, turn around on a dime.
So you've made the Mao comparison a few times, François. Xi Jinping thought as an actual volume, it feels so much like Mao's Little Red Book. But is that a fair comparison, or is Xi Jinping thought more like a throwback to Chinese emperors laying down the law in a draconian way?
I think it's a bit of both. The ubiquity reminds one of the Cultural Revolution from the Little Red Book, was printed with hundreds of millions of copies and people waved it. But again, it's also a compendium for governance. And in that, he emulates traditional emperors. A real characteristic of Xi Jinping is that he really fills all available space. One wonders what his colleagues, of course, and people who are subjected to this. You also get sycophants, people who will flatter you. The amount of pictures that one gets now from Xi Jinping's visits in the provinces that look very much like a North Korean leader, you know, with the people obediently clapping or smiling and standing behind him. It's very impressive.
Xi seems to want it all, a communist state with capitalist values, a modern China, but fused with Confucian ideals that are 5,000 years old. What is the chance that this philosophy in a classroom of young people with networks across the globe, that it comes across as something that doesn't lead to cohesion, but really confusion.
I would take back the bit about capitalist values, because the turn that China is taking right now is much more about a socialist welfare policy, limitation of inequality, hitting at the symbols of success, which means entrepreneurs. This is a new turn.
Mm.
In a way, Xi Jinping is closing this era of 30, 40 years inaugurated by Deng Xiaoping, where, you know, pragmatically you load entrepreneurs, you welcome foreign capital, and you used it to make China grow faster. I think we are coming to the end of that period. And in that sense, I doubt very much that he will emphasize capitalist values.
Do you think the Chinese take Xi Jinping thought seriously, or are they just going through the motions?
You know, it's always very difficult to guess people's minds, and obviously there are no reliable opinion polls, and nobody is going to freely tell you what you're seeing. The more you get to have contact with the people we know, who tend to be public intellectuals or experts, not the common people whom we seldom meet, the more you can see there is skepticism, and there's probably hatred of Xi Jinping by the people who have suffered, if only because of the fight against corruption or because of the fights inside the party and the total dominance that he has established. For the common people, I would suggest they are very fatalistic about political power. Xi Jinping is very distant to them. They appreciate probably the order that is being kept. Order is very important in China. And levels of income that would keep rising it's his insurance policy.
François Gaudemont, author of Les Mots de Xi Jinping, that would be the words of Xi Jinping. Thank you very much for your time and thoughts, François.
Thank you.
And that's going to do it for us today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong. We'll see you right back here tomorrow. From PR.